You're listening to the Inverse Theater Podcast, hosted by playwright Kirk Wood Bromley.
Hey, so this is my first conversation with Dan Berkey, for whom I wrote Remission. Daniel Martin Berkey. As you're going to hear, I met Dan a long time ago in New York City. I first encountered him on stage in Horse Country by C.J. Hopkins, a play, amazing play, in the Theatorium, the present company Theatorium, run by John and Nancy Clancy, who went on to found the New York International Fringe Festival with Alina Holy and Aaron Bell. And Aaron Bell obviously figures significantly in my theatrical history, as you'll hear elsewhere. So, Dan, you know, I don't know what to say. You're going to hear everything in the podcast. Dan is a unique, powerful, brilliant person and actor. And it has been an incredible journey to write this play for him. This is, you know, it's been 20 years, I guess, now since around that when I first started sort of chatting with him about the play and working on the play. This conversation basically touches on how we came to devise and think about and collaborate on the text that became his one-man show, Remission, about his remission from schizophrenia, journey through and exit out of. So, again, it's amazing to be able to know Dan and speak with him and work with him and be trusted by him and listen to him and get into his head and depict him and live through what he's lived through. It's been incredibly informative and transformative for me as a writer to encounter, I guess we'll call it schizophrenia in his person, and to face the challenge of writing something that bears the integrity of his actual experience. So yeah, here it is, me and Dan talking shop.
All right. Hello, Dan.
Hello, Kirk.
Thank you for coming on the podcast. This is the first time you've been on. This is the first time I think you and I have spoken in this way. Certainly, we don't talk much on the phone. We don't talk much on the computer. But I'm excited to chat with you. I hope this is the first of several conversations we have. And my goal is to just plumb your mind and hear from you about Remission. And I thought we would start the very first conversation we have about Remission in talking about the actual production. So going all the way back from how we got the idea of doing this show, how we met, how we worked together in developing the text, and then what it was like to actually rehearse the play and perform the play. I think it would be good to do that first, and then maybe
I've got all this in my head, and all I have to do is just hit the start button in my head and start talking. I mean, this is what goes way back to, I remember the first time we contacted each other was in the summer of 2006. I was still living on Long Island. I was going to a rehab program at that point for drug and alcohol, which was successful. And we contacted each other, and we've been talking a lot about doing a show together. And previous to all of this, when we met prior to my remission, that is cessation of all schizophrenic symptomologies, I was still pretty kind of bouncing all over the place. And so that wasn't going to work out. I remember meeting you at, what was that pancake place on the East Village? And you said, I was like, totally schizophrenic in your borscht. And I laughed about that. And I didn't take offense to that at all because we couldn't work together. I had to go through this, which was a complete cessation of all symptomologies that are related to the schizophrenic condition. Now, that's a vast and complicated thing. But we first talked in the middle of the summer of 2006. And I remember coming into the city and meeting with you when you were living there in Brooklyn. And we would take walks into the park, Prospect Park, and we would talk at length about what my experience was when I was young, when the angels appeared, when the voices started appearing, when all these things started happening to me when I was a very young kid. And it did start very early with me. And we went through this whole story. It took days and days and days and days and days and days and days, which was wonderful because you have a constant dialogue about it. I did most of the talking. You asked some of the questions. We're constantly taking notes. And it was a matter of just getting it all out, because I knew your mind could process it all, and it did. And that was nothing that was a surprise to me, that this came out really well. And you just took it all in. And long story short, I mean, I could go into all the symptomologies that I had, the angels appearing and the demons appearing and Timothy and all of that, my schizophrenic ghost that was kind of helping me along in a way, was kind of me, myself helping me along, as I understand it now. It's a condition where you are healing the psyche, as I still believe. And I can't prove it in a way, but since there has been no decomposition in terms of the symptomology since that time, oh, yeah, I get depressed, and sometimes I get anxious, and sometimes I talk to myself, but none of the delusional thinking, extreme delusion, well, I'm an actor, so I guess delusional thinking goes with the territory, but in control, I have a say when it starts. And none of the voices have appeared again in my head. I haven't seen anything. And there's this terrible, terrible paranoia, fear that got me locked down for so many times, so many days, so many weeks, back when I was young, prior to us getting to know each other. The long and short of it is you came up with a number of drafts, I remember, that were trying to incorporate some of these ideas. And this is kind of months down the line. I had since moved from Long Island, where I was, to my Brooklyn abode. So it was very easy for us to get together and go to 440 Lafayette and a number of other places where we kind of rehearsed and kind of did bull sessions. We read a couple of drafts that you had completed, and they were getting there. They were like shots at it, like blasts in the dark. Like it was coming out of your mind. It was coming out of your mind constantly. And sometimes I remember you would send me some emails with some of the portions of the text, and I was thinking, it's remarkable. All these things that were flashing out of your mind that were kind of like corroborate with some of the things that I experienced in my youth and what I was going through at that time, which was kind of like sliding into a sobriety, a lane, kind of an even strain, if you can call it that. It was no longer the Himalayas. It was more like the sloping slopes of in New England. That's what I was thinking. The mountain range had kind of dulled itself, so I was able to stabilize. I was able to move along the peaks and the valleys in a way that I could communicate what was going on, which was a consistent storm. And that storm has always been there. The storm is there now. It's like one of the lines, being post-schizophrenic doesn't mean I'm no longer schizophrenic, blah, 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 which is true. There is an essence in me that is always belonging to that schism, that separation of self, whatever you want to call it, into a compartmentalized kind of portions of yourself, where it's like a scattergram. And that's another thing that came in the final draft of remission, which was a long process to come to the final draft. That eventually went into the 2009 New York Fringe Festival that was accepted. That we had a performance scheduled in there. But that's like skipping over a lot of really important meetings that we had. And I was going through a storm at that time. There was part of me that was like rebelling against this. There was part of me that didn't quite believe that I was in remission. There was all sorts of disbelief. But that was generated from me, because I didn't quite believe that I had finished it all, that it had just come to a complete cessation. It had, but I hadn't quite grasped that yet. And so we would talk and we'd go through these sessions. There was always a bit of a doubt. It was kind of like I was separated from myself and I was always doubting. It's kind of looking at us doing this. And more as we did it, that kind of splitting off from myself and watching myself doing it as we would do it and listening to you and myself talking and this kind of triad going on, I began to land over the months. I began to come firmer on the ground saying, yes, I'm more or less sane now. I've come to myself. The symptomology is gone. For whatever reason, it is over. And the final vision that I had that you so eloquently put in the final chapter of Remission, it's so eloquent, it's so quite beautiful, is exactly what happened to me on that street in Bay Shore. And I don't want to necessarily go into that right now in terms of verbatim. It's in Remission. I mean, it is in the final chapter. It's an extraordinary epiphany and coming to grips with what's going on. And there's always these models that we have that are going on in our psychology in order for us to utilize logos in order to communicate with the world and the world to communicate with us. There has to be some sort of filter. So I used the Judeo-Christian model. It was just part of me ever since I was born. It was hammered into me. So that model was already there. So that model was extant in order for me to understand kind of what was happening. It's not like some divine power was overlooking this and like controlling it with a bunch of strings. It was just happening in my psyche. I can't explain it. I think the closest anybody has ever come to explaining it is some of the portions of C.G. Jung. Some of his explanations, even those are models, and a lot of them have actually been debunked since then, but the depth psychology continues on. So it was a wonderful dialogue that we had at that time, and it continued on for so long, and it became part of my life in a way that it was like part of the show that was being generated. And it's kind of interesting that that was never part of the show, but I kept on thinking this slide into the show, this dialogue that I'm having with Kirk is kind of like a partnership, and he's getting to know more about me, I'm getting to know more about him, and everything, personality, intellectual, all those things are funneling into it. But there was never a mention of that path, what we took together in the actual piece Remission, which I thought was not so much a shame. It was just so much a part of it, though, that we had to kind of clip it off and then start Remission, which was the piece, as you so eloquently put down, which was my journey through this phenomenon, which to this day I still don't completely understand it, but it was very much a part of my life, the schizophrenic part of my life. I look back on it as being something that was very,
well, you know,
unique in a way. Pardon me? What did you say?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that, what I want to say, a couple things. I have a couple questions, but also on the issue of our dialogue and on the issue of me being in the play and our relationship of subject and writer, being in the play. You know, I realized quickly when we started talking about doing the play that my challenge was to understand what it was like to be schizophrenic and write a schizophrenic character, someone who is experiencing schizophrenia. And so I had to, psychologically and intellectually empath that state of mind. And so I always kind of felt that, you know, I wrote the words in the play, but they were very much the condensation of your personality and your verbiage and your experiences. And you know, pretty much everything in the play is something that you kind of talked to me about, or at least elicited in me. And so I did always feel like our relationship was in there, because if for a third party to come and read the text or see the performance, they have to realize that it's a marriage of you and me, and we're both up there, and you're portraying my version of your life. The fact that I did that and that you did that is a testament to how deeply we got to know each other in researching and thinking about the play. So let me go back a little bit, because you're absolutely right. I mean, we had a meeting at Veselka when you first suggested to me that we that I write a play for you. Now, what I want to get onto is even a little before that, because I'll say this. I was a playwright living in the city. I was doing plays, but I had seen you perform. You, to me, were a legend, like a rock star. You, I saw you in C.J. Hopkins's play, the Cowboy Mouse. Right, Horse Country, exactly, Horse Country, and Cowboy Mouth is Shepherd. Right. Horse Country, Horse Country is a better play than Cowboy Mouth. And it was unbelievable. Like everybody I brought to that show just thought that they were watching a hurricane in human form. And so I had great admiration for you as an actor. But now, it strikes me that you had also seen some of my work, which is why you came to me and said, "Kirk, I think you're possibly the person to tell my story. Can you tell me why you thought I was right and what you had seen of mine that made you think I might be able to do due diligence and pay high credit to your experience?"
Well, I had been a follower of Inverse Theater for quite a while, even before we kind of introduced ourselves to each other. I had seen, and I'm having a mental block right now, it was another single-person play about...
Yeah.
What was that?
That's right. You had seen... Yeah, so you... Syndrome. You saw my play that I wrote for Josh Berg, who had Tourette syndrome. Mm-hmm. And so you saw that play and thought, okay, that clicked with you. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw it twice. It was transcendental for me. It was a very transcendental experience for me to watch that, not only to appreciate the man on stage who was actually going through and had that condition, but the writing and how it was communicating to the audience. And I went, wow, that is exactly what I envision as what's needed in order for me to communicate what I've gone through. I don't know how to do it myself. I'm not a writer. I'm not a writer like you. I'm not a writer like that who creates a dramatic character that communicates to an audience. I write, yeah, but it's mostly internal type stuff for myself. But I said, this guy has got, I've got to talk to him, because this is the energy and the incision, the scalpel that you possessed to cut away the flotsam and jetsam and get to the heart of it. And you had done that with this play about Tourette syndrome. So I was completely taken by that. And I said, yeah, Kirk is the guy for this. I have to come together. But at that time, and it's kind of ironic in a way, and I laugh about it, because I was still going through the condition of schizophrenia. I was still experiencing all those things that
had
eventually come to know about me. But
that's
they
right.
were... The obfuscating, they were kind of an obstacle in their own right in order to get anything done, because my mind was still so kind of disorganized. And CJ,
yeah, well, you know, you're,
and this is a beauty, the horse that CJ captured with those words, things that were going on in me, but he had intended to do this in the kind of the global, he wanted to look at the American schizophrenic landscape. He even used that term, and I'm going, wow, I mean, this is my landscape. And the way communicating that, talking CJ's words that were so disjunctive, going from place to place, landscape to landscape, landscape to landscape, bleeding into all of these different landscapes, was the way I was living. And so I just surrendered myself to that fucking thing. It was like letting go of something. That's why I think CJ's piece was probably the most successful that I've ever done in terms of a theater piece that was written by another person before Remission. It's because it was about me. And I never said that, but it was about me. And then the worst possible thing that could have happened, which did happen occasionally, I was completely separated. I was severed from not only Fred or Eric Dean Scott, who I was partnering with, the audience. There were a couple of performances I was completely severed, cut off. And that is the kind of thing that became an obstacle. John Clancy, who had directed it, he didn't like that. He thought it was some sort of actor failing that I had. He didn't know at that time that it was just me, that sometimes it gets cut off. But anyway, without going into that, the best of Horse Country was able to be myself completely with no walls, and the worst of it when those walls clammed in. And suddenly I can't say a fucking thing to anybody. And I'm cut off. I got so cut off and I got so paranoid once, I dropped shows. I called up and I can't come into the theater. I can't come into the theater. I can't do it tonight. I can't do it tonight. So John ended up having to go on for me. And CJ and John were beside themselves. They go, what the fuck's wrong with Berkey? They didn't know that the very thing that they were performing in front of these audiences at the prison theater was exactly what was going on in me. They didn't know that. But this goes on and on and on. You also wrote sort of an ode to Marky Wrench Theater, which I think is quite wonderful, in the piece, which goes on. But you see, now I have control over things. I jump from landscape to landscape, but I know I'm doing it, so I can retrace my steps and talk about something that I mentioned maybe 10 minutes ago. Whereas before, when I was in the throes of schizophrenia, I couldn't do that. That was not possible.
Okay, yeah, let's talk about that, because you're absolutely right. The first meeting we had was at Fasolka, and I had never met you in person. I'd only seen you on stage, mm-hmm. and you talked to me about writing a play for you because you had seen Syndrome and you really liked it. But my sense of what I guess they would now call your vibe, I was scared. I thought, I seem to remember. You were talking about Monkey Wrench and some of the people in it. You seemed a little vengeful. You seemed a little angry. It was definitely like, and I remember I walked away and I think I said to somebody, maybe my wife or friend, I said, you know, he wants me to write a play about him, his schizophrenia, but he's actually schizophrenic. And I don't know, you know, I worked with Aaron Bell on Icarus and Aria a few years before we met, and he wanted real gangsters to play the gangsters in the play. And, you know, it didn't sit well with me. And so I remember just feeling like this guy's too unpredictable, too wild. Now, then we met again. You actually contacted me again. You, to be frank, said you had a little more money, because I was always very hesitant to take on commissions because I'm the kind of person who has 25 plays that he's waiting to write that are coming right out of his head. And so I was always hesitant about commissions, but you had some more money and you wanted to meet me again. And we met again and you were a completely different person. Like none of that was there. And so what you're saying to me is when we had that first sit down, you were still having schizophrenic symptoms. You were still quote unquote schizophrenic. But when we had that second sit down, that was after your incident in Bay Shore on the side of the road where all your symptoms disappeared. Is that correct? Can you talk about that transition and that transition and what those meetings were like for you and what the difference between the first Dan and the second Dan were?
Well, at the Zelka, I remember being scattered, and I remember meeting you, and I was excited about it. I had no conscious recollection. I have no conscious recollection right now of being angry, but I can understand you saying that, and I completely believe you, because I was all over the place. I was like what they call a Roman candle, and that's the way I was. And it's ironically enough, when I was excited about something, I was more a Roman candle than any before. It's like I was shooting off sparks constantly. And that could be good, but that could also be very off-putting. And it was not just off-putting for you. It's been off-putting for a lot of people in my life, whether that's relationships, whether it's familial relationships, whether it's lover relationships, whether it's business relationships. It's just off-putting to be in a room where suddenly somebody becomes a walking hand grenade. And you know that to be true. It's not just a trope. It's not just something funny to talk about. No, this guy could go off any moment. He is like walking Klaus Kinski. He's somebody that you really don't want in the room because you just don't know if this guy's going to go off and tear the wallpaper off the room. And that sounds kind of funny in recollection, but that's true. I was desperately looking for somebody, some connection. There were so many things that were going on in me in that time. I was drinking again, and I was trying to stop, and the voices were hammering away at me, and I was desperately trying to reach out to find some ground, some anchor. And that's one of the reasons why I went to you, because I was looking for it, and I understood why you couldn't take me on. I understood that perfectly. I didn't take offense. I actually didn't even think about it much at the time because my mind went on to other things that completely had nothing to do with Kirk Brownlee. And so it was all over the place. So I don't really remember so much in particular that meeting at Veselka, other than it was frenetic. I was like, now I'm very excited, but I'm more coherent. I'm talking about something very specific, and I know what I'm talking about. I was all over the place. Now, the second meeting that we had, this was after I was in the process of going through rehab, and my mother had passed away, and she left me a big inheritance. That's the reason why I had this big pot of gold. And that was, I went, oh my God, I've gone through this. My mind is no longer jumping beans. My mind is suddenly stable. And that was a frightening thing, just to get used to the fact that right after this sort of experience that I had with the hypercube and all that on the street, I was like really nervous about it. I didn't know what to make of it, but I just had to kind of like take every moment, one by moment after a moment, and just realize that this might happen again. It might start. I don't know if it's really over. But when I had that pot of gold, I'm going, I know what I want to do with it. I have to get back to the city. I have to find a place to live. At that point, I was still living in a sober house in Bay Shore. Nice people, but I was kind of anchored there. I had all this money in the bank suddenly, but I didn't know how to use it in order to get to place. I finally found this really nice guy, Walter Fleming, who lived in Brooklyn. I don't think you ever met him, but he allowed me to come into his home and kind of live in his basement in a sleeping bag. Nobody wanted to rent to me. Nobody wanted that. And I understood why, because here I am coming out of the blue. Who the hell are you? Okay, you got a lot of money, but where did it come from? Blah, blah, blah. So a lot of suspicions. But I found that place, and I'm going, Kirk, that I got to talk to Kirk, because now I have the money, and he needs the money. I'm going to commission this. I can't just ask him to do it for free, because it's way, way too much to ask anybody to do this gratis. This has to have significant money. So I made my plan that I was, when I talk to you next, I have the money in the bank. I can write out a check to you, and we can start working on the preparation of remission. That was in 2006, and it took 3 years. But that was the start. That was the ignition. That was so exciting that one day when I remember meeting you, I can't remember exactly where it was. It was on the street or at your place, but I handed you the check. I handed you the check, and I remember the look in your eye, and it was very grateful. You were very grateful because I knew I'd given this guy kind of free license. He can stop worrying about making all this money. He probably needs more money, but this is a significant amount of money in one fell swoop that he can kind of get rid of all the other things that are kind of pressing him in terms of creditors and work with me on remission. Is that accurate?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, let me make clear, you know, I seem to remember you, let's be transparent, because I think it's to our credit, it's to your credit. You paid me $30,000, which was, you know, for me, that was around what I needed to make for a full year. And I knew that the play would take me a year or more. And then I knew I'd spend 3 or 4 hours a day on it. And $30,000 was huge money for me at that time. And I also was aware that, I know you're talking about how you got this huge inheritance, and I'm not asking you to say how much it was, but I could tell, and I know, I mean, I think I kind of know how much it was, but I know that $30,000 was a significant chunk of that inheritance. We're not talking like you got $2 million. You got an inheritance from your mom that was, in, honestly, pretty modest, and you spent a good chunk of it on getting this play written. Well, and that was very impressive.
It was 450,000.
Okay.
That number, that's 450,000 with some change. That was the inheritance. That was the amount that ended up in my bank. That's more money than I've ever had in my life.
And that's a good amount of money. It's no doubt a good amount of money, and God bless your mother for leaving it with you. But you know, it was a lot of money you gave me, and I felt really. It was a moment for me. I don't think I'd ever been paid to write a play. Well, I was paid to write Syndrome, but I was paid a lot less. So when you paid me, I said, "Well, this is it. I'm going to do this." And you know, I'd only written one other one person play, but I was excited to move to a new topic. This was a topic that excited me, interested me. I thought this is a gold mine. Like, this guy, you know, is a brilliant actor, and he's got an amazing story, and he wants to act it himself. It's going to be super hot. An interesting thing about Syndrome is I knew Josh Berg as an actor, and he asked me to write a one man play for him. he got a little bit of his money because somebody in his family, I think, is involved in Weight Watchers. But he wanted me to write a play for him. So we spent like weeks trying to figure out what this play was going to be about. And one day he kind of dropped the idea that he had Tourette's. And I was like, oh my God, like you should have told me that in the first place. So we started, but right away, to me, the chance to write about Tourette's was exciting because it's an interesting verbal situation for a person. So it lent itself well to the kind of long wordy plays that I write. But then to meet you and hear your journey through schizophrenia, I thought this is just incredible because, you know, with voices and characters and the type of language poetry that I'm interested in, this is going to be really exciting. Now, I think that I want to say, just because it's on my mind, you know, the thing that I struggled with and that I the edge that I walked while writing this play was that, you know, a lot of schizophrenia, when you're experiencing it in another person, and I'm sure when you're experiencing it as a person who's experiencing it, a lot of it comes off as very cryptic and wild and scary and kind of on the edge between sense and nonsense, between violence and intimacy, between meaning and madness. And I knew that I didn't want to write a play that was like schizophrenia 101, you know, the ABCs of schizophrenia. Like I wanted to have you being schizophrenic on the stage, the way that I had Josh being Tourette-ic on the stage, like actually ticking on the stage. And so my challenge was to give you text that wasn't just a fever dream that made no sense to anyone and wasn't gripping, and I guess, just to use a bad word, a narrative sense. So I wanted to walk that line between having there be the story of a person, but also have the play really head out into strange territory and get really crazy and really edgy in terms of its playing with nonsense and odd language formulas. And so that was that's what I felt like my challenge as the writer was. Now, talk to me about your challenges. Like what was challenging to you about recycling and rethinking and remembering your whole journey through schizophrenia, but then also performing it through the words of another person?
Well, I put it in two compartments here. First of all, relaying it to you, talking about the particulars, talking about the experiences themselves. I thought it'd be very easy at first. I thought it'd be very easy just to open my mouth and talk about the various experiences I had from a young child on through my young adulthood and then into my adulthood under the umbrella of schizophrenia, whatever that condition is. And at first, I found it very difficult. At first, I found myself wanting to lie, actually. I felt at first I wanted to diffuse the truth. And that was just fear on my part, because I was just getting to know you. And I knew you as a playwright. I'd seen your plays, and I was very, very impressed with all of them. But I didn't know you as an individual yet. And so opening up, talking about such an incredibly intimate thing, the nuts and bolts and the gears of Dan Berkey's psyche, was hard. But I said, trust him, Dan. I kept saying, trust, or don't lie. Don't leave anything out. Don't leave anything. I would lose sleep, actually, worried, what is he going to do with this? Dan, are you being paranoid? Is this paranoia? Is this happening again? No. It's rational. I'm telling a person that's essentially a stranger to me personally some incredibly, potentially damaging personal information. And so I've struggled with that. I struggled with that for quite a while. But I said, I'm not going to stop. This is not going to happen. I commissioned him. I'm going to be as truthful as fuck. I'm going to give him everything. And I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt that he's a trustworthy, honorable individual, because that's what I sense from plays and all. But still, you know, you don't know the person. You don't know the individual. You don't know what's really going on. You can really, like a good example, you can know somebody really, really well, and they turn out to betray you. They turn out, they stab you in the back. And it's after years of knowing somebody, and they finally turn the goods on you. It's kind of like you're confronting a friend of yours who's kind of a double agent in a way. And suddenly you find out that they're against you. That's a terrible thing. That's a horrible betrayal. And that's only happened to me once, but it was a long time ago. But that's not even part of this equation. So point being is that I had a hard time letting go of the distrust, but I eventually did. It only took several months. But after the several months after I'd been back in Brooklyn, it was now 2007. We're now in winter. And I was trusting you. And I came to really look forward to our walks, our talks, because it was very uplifting for me. Now, after that point, it was very easy. I just said, this guy is totally trustworthy. I'm giving him my life, and I trust him with it. And I still hold that to this day. I trust you with my life, because I gave you some things that most people wouldn't want to give to another human being. But you've shown me your incredible integrity by giving me not only remission, the final thing, but everything that's happened before, since, and now. Anyway, actual performing of it was a perfect storm of conflict and elation, of ecstasy and suppression, of being released, of being free and being shackled at the same time, which is what I thought, which actually that tension, which was there pretty much throughout every performance, actually lent itself to it, that tension of letting go of something that's incredibly intimate. And the fact that you had that touch sequence, the second major portion of the thing was the touch, where I actually touch people. And that is a big thing. That's a major step where I, over 75% of the people in the audience, I actually wanted to touch as many people as I could. I didn't want to hit them or nudge them or anything. I wanted to be very gentle about it. But that takes away the fourth wall. That takes away the distance. Suddenly they're there with me. They can't deny it. They can't deny it. This is a real human being, flesh and blood. And they're connected to me, whether they like it or not. And there were some people that refused to touch me, and I didn't take that personally. I kind of sense what they might have been sensing. This is dangerous territory, and it's not usually traffic during a theater performance. But that was very necessary, that touch sequence, because I relaxed. But that tension was always there. I'm shackled, and I'm freeing myself. I'm shackled, yet I'm free. I'm shackled and free at the same time, simultaneously, which is a very strange experience. I can't put that into words except saying those, which is a narrative, one sense after the other, but they're together. They're at the same time. It's correlative in a way to being an alcoholic, where wanting a drink and having a drink are simultaneous, where there's no separation. That's why it's so hard to stop. Because you want the drink, you have a drink. It's simultaneous. There's no separation to it. That's why there needs to be a drink, and that whole thing has to be split apart. But that brings up another subject, which is interesting too, because you also talked about my alcoholism and drug addiction to quite an extent in the play, which was very appropriate. But that's about kind of my thoughts on it, on that question.
Yeah, I'm glad you bring up the touch section, because I can't remember what the genesis of that was, but I think my instinct was that, you know, the average person's response to someone who seems schizophrenic is to be scared of them and to flee them and to make sure you don't touch them, because they're almost like lepers. You know, you might catch what they have. They might jump at you. They might get violent with you. And, you know, and I've actually read that schizophrenics are not more violent than the average population. That's a complete myth. They're mostly violent to themselves. But what I wanted to have people do is touch someone, or at least be asked to touch someone who is a cognitive leper, and to start off on that foot and to realize that we are in this room together. You're with this person who really smells of scary. But we're gonna try to get through that. But at the same time, you know, I didn't want to shy away from you being scary. Scary in the sense of, like, you seem unpredictable and you seem mad in the ancient sense. And because I knew that we were going to finish with you coming out of that and making some oatmeal and coming to seem really personable and friendly and safe to be with. So, did you feel, what was your general feeling of the interaction with the audience during the performance? Did you feel like you were a madman in a cage and people were staring at you in a freak show? Did you feel you were teaching them? Did you feel you were sharing something really personal, or did you feel like you were sharing this insane tone poem? What did you feel you were doing when you were on stage?
Well, that only the fear quotient, the fear aspect of it was present during the whole opening section, which was almost 15 minutes, where I was determined to make contact with everybody during that. Then came the text section, but just that opening section, I had to make contact with people. And I really loved the second time I did it at Performance Space 122, where there was no dimming of lights. I saw everybody. Everybody was on the same level. And so I could see everybody's eyes. I could see everybody's expression. I could see what they were doing. And I wanted to talk to everybody. And during the initial performance cycle, the only people I could see were usually in the front row. So I said, I'm going to talk to them. Obviously, the lighting is such that I can't see everybody, but I'm going to talk to the people in the front row. And the whole thing in the beginning was to make contact with them. And that required me making absolute sense, ultra, ultra specific sense of that opening section, which was a wonderful challenge for me, because once I did that, if I made that ultra specific, like I'm talking to people, with these rather abstruse sentences that most people look at, and I've had people look at it, they go, how did you perform this? This doesn't make sense. I said, okay, you have no idea how much study went into this, and it would. To most people, looking at the text raw, without any context at all, they'll go, this is just a word salad. This doesn't make any sense. But it does make sense, because you have to know what's going on. And I did. And I wanted to make absolute sense of that opening section. So once I did that, there was a launch. And most of the time, I felt very successful with that. There was always, it was kind of a mixed bag. It was not 100% successful, but I needed to make that contact. And with the touch section coming immediately after, that was a joyous thing. I could say probably pretty confidently, 95% of all the performances that I did after the touch section, it was like a piece of cake. I don't mean to diminish the complexity of it, because, of course, it's very complex, but I've worked on it for so long with you. I just surrendered to it. I just let go. And that was a wonderful feeling of letting go with that tension that was still there of being shackled and emancipated at the same time. That's the best way of me explaining it. But barring that, I felt like I could let go after that touch section. And for the very, there was only a couple of moments during a couple of the performances where I felt really disconnected in what I was saying. And I remember I stopped during one performance. I just stopped. It wasn't a place to stop. It wasn't a break between sections. I just stopped and stood there. It wasn't that I blanked out. I said to myself, Dan, you're just spitting out words. You're not connected to this. Stop fucking around. And it must have been a minute of me just standing there. I don't know if you were there. This was at the original. I just stood there and started up again, but with much more commitment to it. And I got back into it with full force. And it must have been kind of a strange feeling, because it had been kind of a trickle of water. Then suddenly there was this tsunami coming at them with the energy. But I had to refine that. I don't know if you remember that. I don't even know if you were even there. You weren't always there. You were there for most of the time. But that was an amazing moment.
I do remember that. I remember it very well. It came across as actually I was convinced that nobody in the audience knew that was a break that had not been planned. It just seemed like a very beautiful pause, like a breathing, a recollecting, and it seemed totally in character. So I do remember that.
Okay, good.
Now you referenced the idea of studying the text, and now I wrote it, but you know I can tell that this very long poem, which is in iambic pentameter, and is very dense and very complicated, would be incredibly hard for someone to memorize. But you did memorize it. Do you want to talk to us about how did you go about getting this play in your body? What practically did you do? How did you do that? Because I call it an actor killer. I can't imagine another human being memorizing this play and living to tell of the experience. But you did it. So what did you do? What's the secret?
At that particular time, my performance was limited, very limited, to doing occasional theater for Peter Dobbin's Storm Theater and working on Remission. And at the time when I began working on Remission, I hadn't done anything with Peter Dobbin's Storm Theater. So I was like, and I had all this money to sit on, so I wasn't working. So what I did was I took the script and pretty regularly I went to Prospect Park and just walked around with the script. I walked around section by section. I would take the first section, just leave that section. And I would walk around all day, meaning 5 or 6 to 7, 8 hours. I would take breaks to eat and hydrate myself, but I would just keep working on the lines. I'd be talking out loud, holding pages, make sure people knew that I was out of the script. And I would work over the lines. I'd work over the section. I'd keep on saying, okay, Dan, that didn't make any sense. Now, what is he saying? What is he saying? What is he saying? What is he saying? Say it again. Say it again. Say it again. And I would talk to trees. I would talk to animals. I would talk to people that didn't know that I was talking to them, but I did. I just completely committed myself to memorizing because I knew I had to get these words into my body. And it's an incredible load of words to get into a body and to have that body make sense and actually live it in that body. And I knew the challenge was before me. It was Herculean. But I didn't think of it in those terms. I just boiled it down to one section at a time. And after a couple of days, I learned that section more or less. And I would, by the end of that session in the park, I'd say that to myself to the best of my ability. And then the next day, I would do the same thing. About that end of the second day, I would pretty have the lines initially memorized. Then I go on to the next section. And that would go on until I got through the entire play. So it was like a couple of months where I was just doing that all the time. All the time, every day. That was what I did. There was nothing else I did. I didn't have a girlfriend. I didn't want a girlfriend. I didn't have anything, but I lived, eat, sleep, pay the rent. I didn't have any need to have a job. I didn't work because I had all that money in the bank and I knew that. So just relax, Dan, just work on Remission. So it was 100%. It was a total devotion. It was a total.
And I seem to remember there was not just the issue of memorizing the text, but you were a cigarette smoker at the time.
Uh-huh.
And when it came to start rehearsing and performing the play, I seem to remember that you had to go through an entire sort of like cleansing fitness rebirth to get the energy. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah, I've mentioned this a number of times to people who have asked me about the play Remission. I said, you know, it was the one big thing, like when we were actually ready to get this up on its feet and we were looking at a performance date with Fringe Festival and all, we were starting to do run-throughs. And I said, I couldn't make it through the first run-through. I could not. I was started up with a lot of energy and I'd get into it. By the 11th to 12th section, I'd be hyperventilating, and by the time I got close to the end, I said, I can't, I gotta stop. And I realized what was holding me back was breath. And I remember usually we would end a rehearsal by going somewhere and having cigarettes. We would talk and have cigarettes and talk and commiserate go over the rehearsal, and we would say, okay, that was done, that was accomplished, we've gone through that, we understand that a little bit better now, puff, 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 puff. It's only ironic that very puffing held it back from actually realizing itself. And then when I got to that point, I'm like, shit, I got to stop smoking. At that point, I was smoking about two packs a day. So it was a significant habit. And I was definitely addicted to nicotine. There was no question about that, saying, I can't go cold turkey. I'll go become a basket case. So what do? I go on the gum. So I remember those full 3 weeks prior to opening that, I was chewing the gum constantly like crazy. I went through two boxes of this fucking stuff. And I kept myself from smoking. And I kept on like going to the gym and breathing and walking and all of that. And by the time I got to the next major run through, I could get through the whole damn thing. I got through it. I got through. It was hard, but then the next run through was easier. Next run through was easier. This is how I quit smoking. This is after a lifetime of smoking. Was 17 years old, and how am I old then? In my 50s, and this is how I quit smoking. I tried to quit smoking before to no avail, and I'd make it like a month.
Wow. You
know, I couldn't do that. I had to start smoking. This is how I quit smoking, because it came down to either you smoke or you do your show. That's the choice you have. So I had to do the show. And by the end of that cycle, when we were done with the pro-Roman cycle and I was going home and I was hefting some of the props and all that, I got home and I'm going, I think I'm going to temporarily keep quitting smoking. That's what I thought at the beginning of it when I went on the gum. I said, I'm going to temporarily quit smoking because I love smoking. I never did not love smoking. But it has its effect on me. And so by the end of it, I'm going, I'm going to keep on temporarily quitting smoking. And since that time, 6 months later, I went on with my life and all that after remission with all the complexities inherent in the life. And I found my Marlboro Reds, my Pall Malls, and Lucky Strikes in a drawer. And there was one moment where I sort of stared at them. Do you want? No. So I took them and crushed them up. They were dried as like brittle. They were like tinder. I just threw them away, and I've never smoked a real cigarette since. That was at the end of remission cycle, 2009. I've never touched a real cigarette since. That's how I quit smoking.
Wow, that's fantastic. We could advertise doing one of my plays as a quit smoking program.
You know what? Yeah. Talk to Kirk Bromley. Do one of his.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was a show. People might not get this from listening to the audiobook, but it was an incredibly physical show. You know, we tried to, I haven't mentioned this, but I directed the show. I had directed something before. It might've been the very first thing I directed. I did that just cause I thought, you know, Dan and I are the only ones that know this play and we might as well just, you know, I'm going to want to, you know, it would be really hard to find someone to take the time and, you know, and also, you know, like you said, like you would not be able to finish a run through and, you know, so you'd paid me to write it, but I thought, you know, I should direct it too. And so in directing and doing the show with you, it was very physical. The bike messenger scene and the Newt Kluke Whaley scene and the bathroom stall scene and the voices and visions and the cube scene, you know, the transformation scene, Marcia. I mean, you were crawling under the table. You were jumping up and down. You were running around in circles. I think in the production, my goal was for this to be a very physical theater because it's very verbal theater. And I didn't want it to have this vibe of, just someone talking at people. I wanted to see what a physical, journey schizophrenia can be, and alcoholism and drug addiction and living on the Bowery and with the toll that it taken on your body. So in a sense, I wanted the play to take a toll on your body. And, you know, it seems like it really did.
It not only took a toll on my body, which I welcome, but it took a toll on the audience. It really put the audience through the ringer. A lot of people praised that. A lot of people loved it. A lot of people did not like that. And it was magnified, I think, I can only speculate, because of the fact I made contact with them, real contact with them, vis-a-vis the Tuck section, is that there was a real split. There were some people that just hated the show. There were other people that just couldn't stop talking about it because it really stimulated things in them. But it was a show that would trigger people because it talked a lot about things that just about 90% of the people could relate to in some fashion. It went through so many different landscapes. And it wasn't just about being a schizophrenic in a mental institution. A lot of people would say, well, that's happening to them. They're in the straitjackets in the state hospital. That's not me. It's something they can disassociate themselves from. But no, this is like a walking person. This is like a person that you might see on the street. And they might be completely out of their mind, and yet they seem perfectly normal. There's nothing that ostensibly is showing them to be dangerous or weird or anything like that. You just don't know what's going on in their mind, and which might come out in some sort of strange manifestation. So people could relate to a lot of the show, and that was one of the beauties of it. It could really, it came down to earth. And again, I mentioned the Touch section brought everybody there. It landed everybody. So consequently, I speculate there was this wide gulf between people who loved it and people who hated it. I don't know if what your experience was on your end. I'm sure you heard a lot. It's not that I don't want to hear it. It's just I heard a lot from people, some of my friends who saw it. They just couldn't stop talking to me about it. They wanted to know more questions. They wanted to have a discussion with it. One friend of mine just didn't say anything at all. Nothing. Nothing. I asked him, and I didn't have any comment. I knew that he had comments about it, but he wasn't willing to share it. I had the sense this really triggered him somehow. And I'm not going to press it. I mean, I'm not forcing him to talk or anything like that. I think that would be kind of mean. But he never, ever came to me and said, you know, Dan, I want to tell you, this really did hit me. He never did that. But I know him, and we've gone outside of each other's company. We've kind of separated and diverged and gone our own paths. He's the kind of person who's not going to talk about things that really bug him. He's going to put on a happy face, a game face. That's just who he is. Yeah. I'm not going to judge him about that. But that's one of the reasons why he just wouldn't talk about it at all.
Yeah, I mean, I had a lot of experience at that time in my life of sitting in the audience as people watched my plays. And there was a thing I used to see a lot of the time, sometimes near the beginning, sometimes by the middle, there would be people in the seats with their head in their hands, their head hanging over. And I used to say it looked like they were being hit by a sledgehammer. They would kind of sulk out of the house. You know, I think that my plays can feel a little assaulting to some people, like, because they're, you know, I saw a headline in the Times the other day about the new play from, I'm not going to remember her name, but you know, it's a play on Broadway now. And, Annie maybe is her first name. But you know, the headline was, for Annie Baker's plays, it's all in the pauses, you know? And so there's playwrights out there who they use a lot of silence and they use a lot of pause. This play was 2 hours of verbal, frenzy and in a sense, I think it can feel really aggressive to people. But I'd like to ask you, can you just run through for me where you have done remission? Because you mentioned you did it in the Fringe Festival, so that was probably 5 to 7 performances. I can't remember. It was over in the West Village somewhere. Then we did it in a solo. I think it was Solo Nova or some solo theater festival.
But you've also Performance Space 122 a year later.
Yeah, and what was that festival called? Do you remember?
No, I don't remember the. I think.
Okay, good. And then, did we?
You went. You and Leo were there. I remember.
Yeah. No, I saw it. I can't remember what the festival was called, but. And then, did you ever perform it anywhere else?
Yeah, I performed not the whole thing, but portions of it at Johns Hopkins. I asked them, "Do you have the I went to the, I just called them, their psychiatric department, and I told them about the play, and I sent them some of the literature and some of the reviews, and I told them about you, I told them about me over the phone, and I also wrote them an email, a lengthy one, and they said, you know, we would like to meet you. Could you come to this, it's down in Maryland, can you take a train down? I mean, we'd be glad to pay for your train, but just to have a chat with us to see what we think. And so it was fresh in my mind. This was not long after Performance Space 122, so the whole play was still in my head. I didn't have to work on it at all. And we talked about it. We went through the play. I can't remember the name of the doctor. There were like five or six of them. I felt like they had me under the microscope. I said, now we've got somebody who's schizophrenic. We can really examine him. And I say, well, yes and no. Okay. And there was a lot of laughter. I performed a couple of sequences, sort of like in the those lecture halls where everything is raked really high. The seats are like, the person in behind you has their like knees in your head, that type of thing, really high. So you're down there on this performance stage with a little bit of table. I had a few props and that. So I would do sections and I gave it up to them. What section would you like? This is a play that we did. I've done it twice, completion. I'm not going to do the whole thing now, but it's all written out. I wrote out the sections to describe them a little bit on a piece of paper, and they were looking over. Could we see the Bowery section? I said, sure, sure, sure. So I'd set that up with a few props, and I'd do the Bowery section. And we'd talk about it, and sometimes I would only do one section where they would talk about it for like 2 hours. And we would talk. We would talk back and forth. And he would talk about the conditions of the mind, and they would talk about theories about what might have been going on. And I kind of kept silent a lot of it. I didn't want to mock them, and I certainly wasn't there to make fun of them at all, but they went into, like, medical head, like went into, like, the whole theoretical, psychological, theoretical medical head. What's that manual that they have with all the listings of the mental conditions? There's a specific name for it. It has been for a long time, but there's lots of additions to it. All the conditions like bipolar.
DSM.
What? It's a manual.
The DSM.
It's a manual.
It's the DSM manual.
Right. No. That's right. That's right. They'd be looking at that, and they'd be talking through it, and they'd say, well, maybe this was going on. Maybe that was going on. They'd get into arguments with each other. They'd say, no. What you just saw. That's what. That's not what was happening. Then suddenly I was like watching them. They were having this argument. And I'm going, this is amazing. But I didn't get paid for it at all. But it was one of the most entertaining things. I did that three times. Twice at Johns Hopkins and one at Columbia, which is just down the road. And the Columbia one was kind of dry. I did a couple of sections for them. They talked kind of a little bit about it. They were very appreciative. It wasn't that they said, oh, shit, we got to watch an actor now. I think they were at first put off, oh, there's an actor. He's going to act crazy. And then when I got into some of the sections, and that one section at Columbia, I did the touch section. And that took them by surprise. That really took them by surprise. I just started right at the end of the introduction section. And I went right into it. And the person that I went to first kind of reared back. And I walked very gently at them. I wasn't accosting them or anything. And I put my hand out, and they kind of looked at the hand. And there was a long pause before they took my hand. And then everybody kind of in the room relaxed. But there was this big jump. Again, they were confronting a human being talking very rationally about something that was at one point totally put him in a total irrational state of mind, but he was being logical. He was being illustrative, and the narrative was sensible. I was making sense of it. So they really liked that. They really liked the fact that it wasn't just somebody on there in their room acting nuts, which, of course, was probably some of them expected that. They didn't get it. And I was actually expecting them to ask me back, but that never happened. So I did that to a total of three times after that. And I went on in my life with other challenges, and I kind of lost track of my relationship to remission. So the challenges arose in my life that I just had to handle and deal with. But that
let me ask you a little bit about that. Did you feel that they were looking at you as entertainment, or were they learning something, or were they did they feel that they were getting insights into schizophrenia, or Did they feel like you were not schizophrenic? And it was interesting to meet someone who was used to be schizophrenic, who's talking about it, like they might find some insights there. What was their curiosity about seeing you do that play and how they approached it?
The people that were from Johns Hopkins, they were very interested in the intricacies of the psychological condition that I had had. And they were totally bought into the fact that I had at one time a totally freewheeling schizophrenic condition that was putting me out of control. And they were very just accepting of it. The ones in Columbia were a little bit reluctant. They, like I said, they kind of had the feeling that they were going to just watch somebody act nuts. And when I didn't do that, they were suddenly very interested in the text. The people at Columbia were more interested in the text as a performative text, yet they had questions about my childhood based on discussions of my mother and my father. They really liked that section when I talked about my mother and my father. There was a couple of people, two women psychologists who really got into that at Columbia, and they kind of overwhelmed everybody else by talking about that mother and son section, mother and dad section about being triggers for abnormalities that sometimes result in a schizophrenic condition in certain people, especially young adults, which the onset is usually like late teens and early 20s. That's classically pretty much statistically when it happens. So they were very curious about the fact that you'd started. They said, you actually started seeing things, I think, when you were like 7 years old? I said, yeah. And they said, that's very unusual. That doesn't usually happen. At least we don't know of that happening that often. It has happened. So they were very curious about my childhood. Therefore, the section that we talked about my mother was a very interesting one to them. But it was more about the text and how that touched on ideas of schizophrenia. The ones in Johns Hopkins were very much interested in me as an individual who had actually gone through that condition. They were talking to me, asking me questions. The ones at Columbia would filter their questions through the text. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's perfect. Thank you. That's fascinating. That's great. Okay, so we've covered sort of when you performed the play, your kind of experience of being on stage. How would you say? Let's ask you. How would you say I did? And I know I don't want you to just be flattery or something. I mean, I'm not asking for like a grade here, but you know. Schizophrenia is a bit of a black box for people. Like it's a dark, inscrutable, really a condition that puts people off, and so they don't maybe have as much experience in relating to it or understanding its intricacies. In terms of, you know, being on stage and doing this language, did you feel, were you having a sort of sympathomimetic recursive sensations of what it was like to have been, quote, you know, schizophrenic? Were you feeling any slippage? Like, were you scared that the play might get you to leave remission? Yeah. Like, what was it like personally as someone who was very dedicated to not having that disease anymore to be revisiting it in that way?
By the time I was actually doing it, that was no longer a fear that I was going to decompensate. I wanted very much to go into a state. I was asking myself, I was pushing myself gently, not actually pushing, but pushing myself psychologically to go into a state where I could give the audience. But I soon forgot about that, really, because the lines conveyed the narrative that was essentially the schizophrenic experience for me, as communicated by you and then again through me, which is about the best that I think I can't say because I can't judge how I looked and how the performance looked. That's that. I can't separate myself from that and watch it. I wish I could. I wish I could watch myself see the play. I wish I could see the play, but I can't. I can't do that. I can only relate to it from the performative end. It just from people who've talked to me about it, they felt like they were in the presence of somebody who had it and was going through it at times. And there were times when I was performing it where I let myself go to such a degree. I can't remember the specific section so much because I wasn't making note of it at the time, but flying in a way that was scary and exhilarating because the lines were there. I had a safety cushion. The lines were there. As long as I knew the lines, the safety cushion was there. I didn't have to worry about falling into the abyss at all, even though I'm not talking about the transcendental abyss, you know, falling into a black hole. I knew I was protected because of the text, and I could go as far as I could find it in myself to do. I felt I had to, I owed it to the audience. And what I didn't feel like I had to owe it to you because we had gone to such a degree as a relationship that this was all part of a relationship. You were there performing on stage with me. You were there with me. And it wasn't about doing anything for you because you were doing it for me. And we were there together. And that there was a symbiosis there that is very unique, very intense, very intimate that I haven't really spoken about. It hasn't got to do anything with sexuality. It got to do with coming together with two minds and coming up with something that's kind of a blend of them and giving that to the audience because I felt I owed the audience that. I wanted to tell them what it was like, not just tell them but show them and let them feel it. Let them feel it. Just open my heart. Just go. And if I fall on my face, if I fuck up, I get completely lost, I can get up and say, hey, I'm lost. Where am I? And that would have been okay. In fact, there was one time I did that. I lost myself. And I went backstage. I kind of jittered back to the sound booth and said, where am I? Where am I? Where am I? What's next? Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And I'd go back to the stage and I'd do it again because I'd actually gotten lost. And I said, fuck it. I'm going to accept the fact I got lost. And I'm going to go find my place again and come back and continue it. And nobody blinked an eye because they probably thought it was part of the play. Because I needed to give as much to the audience as I possibly could. And that's why this was the swan song for my performance on stage. I could not go back to doing lines, learn lines, stop, don't bump into the furniture and do 3 months, 1 month of it. I said, fuck that, I can't do that anymore. This has shown me what it is to really perform it, really bring something to life. And I think of how the Romanians did it, how many of the great Andrei Serban would talk about, Lucien Pintile, Andrei Serban, Livia Chule, they would talk about working with the actors for months and months and months and months before they would actually be on stage. And so that's how you, when you indoctrinate actors into that style, where you are asking them to devote themselves entirely to this piece for a year, and you're not getting much in terms of money or anything like that, to devote themselves to it, that's how to bring, that's how to realize a true piece of theater. So, and after I had done it, I couldn't go back to the regular regimen of learning lines and doing regular plays. That was the end. After that, it was all film. I realized that was my segue into the world of film. And it made perfect sense in a way because I couldn't go back to doing the plays the way I'd normally done. It didn't make any sense because I'd done remission. This is how to do a play. This is how to realize a play, work on it for a full year or more. Then put it up in front of an audience. That's when you can truly live it. So that also, remission remains to be the only play that I've ever done where I actually got to be like 90% realized. I can honestly say that 90% of that was through my body and gave to the audience. It could have gone on for years and I'd still be discovering things. But that gave me the opportunity to really show an audience what it is to truly inhabit a play and give it out. I'm just repeating myself because after that, I just couldn't go back to the regular regimen. It made no sense. So I gave that up and turned to film.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is remission was the last play you ever did?
2010 at Performance Space 122. And I walked off that stage. It was the last stage I ever walked off of. That was it.
Wow.
I wasn't willing to go back. Wow. It made no sense. Does this make sense to you? I had to give it up because there was no place for me to go after that. No place except film. I wanted to devote myself to film. Because that was a medium that I didn't
know. Absolutely.
What?
Yeah, that's right. I know that. And I've been happy to see that you have been actually doing that. Can you tell me then, what was it like recording the audiobook? Sitting in a chair in my house, tiny little room, coming back to this thing 12 years later. What was it like doing recording the audiobook?
An amazing experience. I even said so, I think. It was re-exploring it, and the fact that I didn't know the lines from memory anymore, but they lived in me. It didn't take long before I was living them again right in front of the microphone. It was just flowing through me. And with your help, with your guidance, I was able to revisit it. And I thought it was just amazing. And I was full of life, and I wanted to give as much to you as I could in terms of the recording for a mic, because I knew that it was just my voice now, and nobody could see anything. And it was the piece is a very visual piece. It's a very physical piece. It's like people have to experience it to see it, not just hear it. But I had to really understand and accept the fact that it's just my voice now. Nobody can see my body. They have no idea what I look like or what I'm doing. I'm giving it to them in the voice. So that has to somehow communicate everything that would have normally been with the whole body. And so I was wondering about that, and I think I gave you a couple of feedbacks where I thought the first section was a little over the top. And I'm going, I feel like I'm hitting people too hard with it. But you said to me, and I trusted you, and I've let go of that. You said, Dan, no, actually, it sounds wonderful. It sounds good. So I'm not a voiceover artist. I don't do voiceover. I don't even like doing it. But I went into the recording of the remission knowing that I'd be working with you on a very intimate thing, and we were going to re-explore it for the microphone. I said, this is an amazing challenge. I don't know how it's going to turn out, but by God, I'm going to give it my all. And the sessions were exciting to me, and they oftentimes ended a lot sooner than I thought they would. But by the time the sessions were over, I was just exhausted. I remember that little room was a sweaty little room to be in, and it was hard. I never felt, I never said to myself, oh, fuck, I don't want to be here. Oh, no, I don't want to do this. No, I wanted to do it. And if ever I was thinking to myself, no, Dan, come on, no, do it again, do it again. You're missing something. Do it again. Listen up, Kirk. Do it again. Because I know you'd tell me if it didn't work, we'd do it again. And I'm going to trust this fact. I'm putting myself in his hands. He's going to tell me that this doesn't work. And you did that. You did that many times. And I was very grateful for that. Because you weren't going to accept a speaking by rote performance. This is going to have to get into it as much as I possibly can. So it was a very exciting time for me. And it was also frightening, but in a good way. Like rock climbing. For a person who's devoted to rock climbing, it's frightening still. Alex Hollow even talks about it's frightening to go up there. It was frightening to go up El Cap. I mean, you must know about the fact he was the only person to scale El Cap with Free Solo. Do you know about that? Well, that's a do or die thing. That is do or die. Those are the two choices he had. I can't think of a better analogy to do truly a performance. It's do it or you die. Really put that into your body, in your mind. It's like thinking of the samurai warrior. You're already dead. It's like The Art of War by Lao Tzu. That's a great book. It's fantastic. Unfortunately, I can't read in the original Asian. I have to read it in translation. But the point is I was just going to go for broke. It was not going to, I'm not going to hold anything back. And it turned out to be an amazing emotional experience for me. And it seemed to be kind of an emotional, exciting experience for you as well. But I'm not going to speak for you.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, I was able to, you know, it's a part of what I'm doing now. I'm preparing my plays for final production, audiobook release, and it was wonderful to, I spent, honestly, like some of my plays, I'm rewriting them intensively. Like it's taken me a year to rewrite some of my plays in preparation for audiobooks. I'm so unhappy with the original But remission, I didn't take that long. I did a little touching up. I did a little tweaking. I added a little section. I got some new thoughts that I'd been having into the play. So I feel like the original text was pretty good. I think I made it better, and so it was exciting to work on it in that setting. And that's a question I want to ask you. You know, I became very aware when writing it that, you know, as we'll talk when we meet next, and we actually can sort of, you know, go through section by section, this play is all very truthful. It's based on a true story, but it's all of this stuff happened to you. It's all from the conversations we had. But I definitely found during it that, you know, my goal was to elicit my own schizophrenic landscape and to find that schizophrenia in myself. And I infused the play with things that didn't come from our conversations, but came from my own imaginings and from my own experience of conjuring schizophrenia in myself. And so the play is really a salad of some of my stuff and a lot of your stuff. How did that settle with you? Were you ever super conscious that, like, oh, here Kirk's kind of tripping out for these eight lines on something that I never really mentioned, but he's blending some of his own things into the mix. And did you feel you were surfing two stories at once, or how did you feel about that blend?
We weren't surfing two stories at once. We created a story together that was one thing. That's my answer to that. I never felt that you were telling one thing and I was telling another. We were telling one story. We had generated that with ourselves. That's even true with the audio recording. We were working together. We were telling one story. And some of the stuff I knew came from your imaginations. And I loved that. And a lot of stuff came from my experiences. There was no feeling of, whoa, what is that doing there? No, we were telling one story, Kirk. There was no separation of stories. It was one story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great. Great. That's great. Well, I'll tell you what, Dan, I think we should wrap. Thank you for talking to me. I think this was a really great, start. Next time, what I want to do is I want to talk through each section and hear more about your story, about what it was like to see those things at seven, what the early years were like, and I'd like to hear some just firsthand accounts of the things we hear in the play, the experiences of the Bowery and all the stuff. So I think next time we meet, we'll get a little more specific about what's in the play, but it's been a joy to talk and reminisce about the generative experience of actually doing the play in the streets of New York. And like you said, getting to know each other and listening to each other and trusting each other. And I'm very grateful. I've always been very grateful for your friendship and your collaboration. And let me say before I give you the mic to you to hear your closing remarks. Everybody should know that when you were coming to my house every day to record the audiobook version of this, which took many, many, many visits, maybe 25, 30 visits to my house of 2 to 3 hours each. You often brought me sourdough bread, that you baked at home. And, it was the best sourdough bread I've ever had. And my daughter and my girlfriend always looked forward to it arriving in the house. So thank you for the bread.
You're welcome.
Why don't you go ahead and, give us your closing thoughts, and then we'll wrap up until we meet again in a week.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed the bread because I continue to make it. It's started out as a hobby during the pandemic lockdown. I wanted to learn how to make sourdough, but I think I've already told you that. But it took on a very serious avocational note with me. It's something I play constantly, and I'm learning a lot about it. It's a science, and you can't get more specific into sourdough baking. I mean, ultra, ultra careful. It's like a scientific experiment when you get down to measuring things down to the gram. and all, understanding fermentation and all. It's a marvelous thing. It's kind of wedding my own scientific past with something that's very scientific in the present, but it's not. It's using a different language, but it's the same kind of thing. It's fascinating. So I make bread for people, and the last time I had a gig, I purposely made a couple of loaves of sourdough and took it to them. And they said, "Who made this?" I said, "I did. I did this. My habit." They said, "Fantastic. Thank you." "Well, you're welcome. You're welcome. It's your habit. Enjoy it. It's something to be had. And it's something that was a great joy for me to do. Like I said, it was a great joy for me to come to your house and meet you again after all these years. And I'm looking forward to doing more. This is a wonderful talk. I really enjoyed myself here. And the idea of getting very specific into the various sections and going through it a little slower is a very exciting thought for me. I also should say that some gigs are coming up. They might be long gigs. And so if we have a scheduled dialogue or talk, that might have to be canceled. I just want to warn you.
Well, yeah, if it has to be, we'll find another time. We'll definitely find the time to do it. Like I said, you know, I think the audiobook's going to be released very soon, but there's no rush, and we'll definitely find time to talk. Right now, we have it scheduled for 1 week from now, and hopefully we can keep that. But if not, we'll rearrange. Right. All flexibility. It's all good.
All right, man.
Bye. All right. Thank you, Dan. Talk to you soon. Ciao, man.
So the song I'd like to end with today is called Haciampa. It's the very first song off our album entitled Red Woman's Revenge. Haciampa is a river in Arizona, and I believe Haciampa means underground river. And indeed, the Haciampa River is, as far as I know, largely an underground river. It flows underground. And the lyrics make some reference to that. They also make some reference to another aspect of the river that I read somewhere. But I thought I'd talk through the lyrics and just see what I discover here. "No one's into me," cries the bolted door. "Through the land of mines, nurturing you pour. Starry, scary, open, frail, and flail. Those who shrink you for their Mary of the truth shall ever ailing fail. Underground, for the birds, wow to wow, bouncing like a water cure. Upside down, rained and drained, through the town, dying in an aquacade. I was such a silly girl when I was a naughty boy. Hook that dirt bag up to me, and I'll fill her up with joy. Haciampa, Haciampa, we shall return you to what you were before we wanted more." So, "No one's into me," cries the bolted door. So there's kind of this immediate sense of futility, of self-defeat, of a bolted door or a self-closed thing, being sad that no one comes into it. And yet, so we have this kind of self-conflict, self-contradiction, self-defeat. So that goes on. But then, "Through the land of mines, nurturing you pour." You is the Haciampa River. And the land of mines is Arizona. So through the land of mines, there's obviously a double play here of possessiveness, underground drilling and gems and possession and value. And through that world, a river pours nurturing. So we go starry, scary, open, frail, and flail. I feel like that goes back to the bolted door. Someone staring out of the bolted door, scared. They open it, they're frail, and they flail. So there's a paranoia, there's a closedness here, an anxiety. And then we say, those who shrink you for their Mary of the truth shall ever ailing fail. What I read about the Hassayampa River was that there was a native story about it, or a native myth, or a native rule, that those who shrink the Hassayampa River, take water from it just for fun or for unnecessary needs, shall never be able to tell the truth. Underground, the river flows for the birds. The birds love the rivers in Arizona. There's also, I think, a double play there. You know, things are for the birds when they're kind of silly or fantastical or even unutilitarian. Wow to wow, moving from one wow to another. If you've ever been near the Hassayampa River, you'll know what that means. You know, even though it's underground, it nurtures the plants on top and it creates these whole ecosystems. Bouncing like a water cure. Water cure is a reference to kind of, you know, obviously therapies that use water. And the river bounces like those. Upside down, and then the river proceeds, and then the river is upside down, which I guess if it's underground, then it's all of a sudden above ground. Rained and drained, it rains in the river is drained, it rains, it's drained, it rains. It flows through towns, and then it dies in an aquacade. An aquacade. I was kind of self-conscious of using that word, but an aquacade is kind of an older word, but it just means a fun park, a water park, a fun water park, where the river is used up. I was such a silly girl when I was a naughty boy. I don't know, that's just kind of referring to some of my life. But if you hook that dirt bag up to me, I'll fill her up with joy. You know, the dirt bag is a negative term we use for people, but I'm not sure why. Being a dirt bag seems kind of cool and interesting to me. But you know, dirt bags feel self-conscious of being dirt, and I just want to say I'll fill that dirt bag up with joy. Maybe I'm the Hassayampa River, right? Hassayampa, Hassayampa, we shall return you to what you were before we wanted more. That's just kind of a promise, you know. We're gonna revive the Hassayampa River. The Hassayampa River is gonna be full again, just like it was before we ever wanted more than the Hassayampa River. Who needs more than the Hassayampa River? Nobody. We just need the Hassayampa River, and we're gonna return you. We're gonna rewild. We're gonna re-river everything. And it's going to be like it was before. That's it. So here it is, the song Hassayampa.
Through the land of mine,
This has been the Inverse Theater Podcast, hosted by playwright Kirkwood Bromley. For more information, visit inversetheater.org.